Welcome, everybody, and thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast. This is the introduction to the upcoming usability testing. The goal of this podcast today is to outline the process that we're going to go through over the next month to make sure that everyone who's taking part in these rapid improvement events, that we're all on the same page and we're able to make them beneficial and efficient.
Yeah, that's right. So just for the new listeners out there, this is a usability test for rear cabins. We've got two platforms that we're looking at. We want to make sure that we've got our stuff squared away.
We want to make an educated decision and be able to provide the trust with some appropriate feedback to help guide the purchase of a new airframe.
So we're lucky enough to have Greg Burrow here, our CEO, here to discuss the background of the project.
So, Greg, if you wouldn't mind, can you just sort of outline the concept behind us getting a new aircraft, the process that we're going through, just so everyone is sort of on the same page starting off into this usability testing.
Sure. Okay, thanks, Andrew and Stefan. No, the challenges that we face are that we are doing 1,100 missions plus a year. We have old aircraft, they're 25 plus years old. They have a maintenance program that reflects the age of the aircraft. And we've just seen an example where we've had one of our aircraft out of the year for a two-week period while heavy maintenance is carried out on that aircraft. These old aircraft make it harder and harder to keep them to the flight line so that we can carry out 1,100 missions a year. We're also conscious that the BK-117 for the clinical teams are small, cramped spaces, and we would love to give them more space. So they are really our two key drivers. One is keeping aircraft to the flight line. Two, giving the clinical teams a more workable space.
Thanks, Greg. Can you just talk about our mission profile? Do you see it changing at all, or do you think we'll remain the same?
Our mission profile is around 85% primary, and about 14 or 15% into hospital transfer. It's unlikely that's going to change. We need an aircraft that is capable of the multi-role and that expands beyond the clinical work we do. It also has to be a good SAR aircraft. It has to be good for winching. It has to be good for a number of things. And that is the New Zealand way, unfortunately, or good or bad, really, but it is something that we need to hang on to. We need to have an aircraft that is capable of a number of different mission profiles. We would like an aircraft that goes further and faster than our current model. We would like to be able to do a greater range of inter-hospital transfer work, but in essence, I do not see the mission profile changing from what we currently do. Over quite some considerable period of time now, we've spent a lot of time looking at aircraft selection. And we've considered a wide range of aircraft types and models. Right now, it's fair to say that the choice has been narrowed down to two types, being the EC-145T2 and the Augusta AW-169. We need to have a clear understanding of the positives and the negatives of both those types, and what each of the types offer the clinical teams is a key part of the decision-making process. So the work that the ergonomics team and the clinical education team are doing together to help advise us on the suitability of type is critical to the selection process.
So I'd like to thank Greg Burrow for his input and for his support in this project. So let's take a couple of minutes here to outline the plan for the upcoming month.
Yep, we've put the curriculum on hold.
So your morning daily simulations will still happen, but they won't be educational simulations. Mm.
The current feedback model that we're using is working well, Andrew.
Yeah, and we'd like to incorporate that into the usability testing, and that's sort of what's driving the idea for this month-long project.
So we're going to continue on with the daily sessions, and we're going to include some rapid improvement events. Do you want to just quickly explain that?
Yeah, so the structure will be that over the next month, we're going to have four rapid improvement events, which are half-day sessions in which we'll do focused testing of the interior cabins. The testing will be simulation-based, and it'll be a mix of clinical scenarios as well as individual skill stations, i.e. performing CPR in the back of a helicopter. Yeah.
So we need to emphasize we're not assessing individuals or teams, quite different. We're assessing the working space or evaluating the working space.
Exactly. So you need to come into these simulations with a different mindset. Mm. They will be challenging, but not in the same way that our daily simulation has been challenging.
People can sort of take a bit of a breath.
Exactly. Exactly. As part of this process, we have to make some assumptions. The biggest confounder in this whole process is the unknown. The AW169 is a new airframe, and nobody is currently using this airframe to provide EMS services.
So we did a beta test yesterday, and it actually came up with more questions than answers, really, didn't it, Andrew?
Absolutely.
Where are things laid out? How do we load the stretcher? Do we go forward or aft, east, west, north, south? Where do we have our gear placement? It was actually quite challenging.
Exactly. So part of what we've taken away from that is that as an educational and an ergonomics team, we need to go out and try and get some of these answers. Again, as the AW169 is not in operation, it makes it somewhat difficult. So we're forced to extrapolate from the big brother, the 139, and also try and get a sense as to what the rear cabin design will look like. In the meantime, one of the assumptions that we're setting is the setup of the interior cabin. And the education ergonomics team has had a thought about this. And as part of your simulations, we will set the rear cabin for you, and you'll be required to work and perform tasks in that space. We will be looking for feedback both on how that cabin feels, but more so on how is it to operate within the space provided. The second thing that our beta test identified is what we're calling a comfort bias. And what we mean by that is that the EC145 cabin is set up very similar to our current BK model, and therefore the way that you practice medicine within that space is similar. The AW cabin is very different, both in size and in the way that it's set up. And therefore, performing routine tasks can sometimes feel awkward.
So what we'd like to do is we'd like to ask the crew to keep an open mind and think about how do we best perform tasks in the space we're in, and what is the patient outcome as a result of it.
Absolutely. The final thing that we would like to take away from this usability testing, given the similarities between the BK and the 145, is that are there ways to improve our current platform? Mm. And if we're able to identify those things, we may be able to institute them in our current model.
Definitely.
So in preparation for this module, we were lucky enough to be able to contact some international EMS providers.
Heavyweights.
Experienced providers in the field who've recently gone through a similar process. We apologize. The interviews between the three of them are somewhat long, but they're definitely worth taking the time to listen to. Two of the guests are Canadian. One is Dr. Mike Betzner, who's the medical director at Stars Calgary. The other is Greg Barton, an experienced flight paramedic from Calgary. And both were heavily involved in a decade-long process there to choose and design the interior cabin for the machine they're currently using, which is an AW139.
The third person is Sam Bindle. Most of you would know and have worked with Sam, and she's been a long-standing friend of ours. And she's got some great insights as well. I totally agree. It is very worthwhile listening to, and it's kind of opened our eyes up a little bit to what we're doing, really.
Absolutely. There's a lot to be learned from other people's experiences.
No point reinventing the wheel, is there, really?
Exactly. So we'd ask you to take the time and listen to these interviews in preparation for our upcoming month.
Enjoy.
So our first guest on the day was Dr. Mike Betzner, and what follows is our phone interview with him. Mike, if you could just take a moment and introduce yourselves to our listeners.
Yeah, you bet. So Mike Bessner. I'm an emergency physician, full-time emergency physician in Calgary, and have been for going on 20 years almost now. And medical director of Stars Air Ambulance in Calgary for almost the same period of time, 17 or 18 years. I've lost track now. Yeah, all exclusive. Had some experience in BC and Saskatchewan and now Manitoba, where our other bases are as well. And happy to talk to you guys about new helicopters and new interiors.
Yeah, so here at the Auckland Rescue Helicopter Trust, we're about to embark on purchasing a new helicopter to serve our mission profile. And as part of that process, in true New Zealand fashion, we've purchased some plywood and 2x4, and we've built two rear cabin mock-ups that we're about to undergo about 2 months of simulation testing, usability testing, to try and determine which cabin design will suit us the best. Without letting the cat out of the bag, we're looking at a side-loading platform and a rear-loading platform.
Sure.
And so we know that Stars has recently undergone a lengthy process to choose a new aircraft as well as custom design a rear cabin. So we're wondering if you could share some insights as a medical director at Stars during that time about that process, lessons that you learned, things that you would change or do differently in the future.
Yeah, so we're currently operating, just to be clear, BK-117, which, you know, around the world, I think you guys use the platform, I'll correct me if I'm wrong.
Yep.
So we're on BK-117 and then AW-139. And, yeah, we went through this exact kind of procedure, I'm going to say now, 9 or 10 years.
So just like to apologize here, guys, we had a little bit of a technical failure, but we were able to get Mike back on the phone for the remainder of the interview. We'll just continue here. So you would just, if you could just reiterate the point that, of the two platforms that you're using and go from there.
Yeah, you bet. So, yeah, we have BK-117, so rear-loading machines, which are still in wide use around the world, great machines still. But getting old and getting hard to get parts for, and I'm sure that's why you guys are also looking at new machines. And then we've got AW-139s at each of our bases now, with the exception of Grand Prairie. And we went through the process you're going through a couple of years, probably 8 or 10 years ago now, and it was about a two-year process. And we did all of the things I think you guys are likely thinking of doing, including the building of mock-up interiors with reasonably high fidelity, actually, in terms of making them exactly the right shape and size. They were built by, you know, our engineers, and so they really were quite good. And we then went through a process with the University of Calgary, and we had lucky enough contacts to be able to have access to 3D simulation laboratories where you'd wear virtual goggles and actually be able to also interact with virtual gear in a neat environment to kind of get a sense for ergonomics and, you know, space-time relationships in terms of how you would interact with potential monitors that we wanted to use. And we could play with our setups quite extensively within these 3D environments and make quick changes and then see how that panned out. So that was a pretty neat process. And I think that boils back to, you know, people thinking that the way that they're going to design things is always going to be better than what someone else has already done before them. And that was, of course, our overinflated ego sort of thinking about this when we were going to get these new aircraft. We thought we're going to build this new interior, and it's going to be awesome, and it'll be the best interior on the market, and why would we buy an off-the-shelf product when we have the chance to be able to do that? So that was our mindset, an extremely egocentric one, which I would really highly recommend that you not do. And the reason I would say that is, although we have this wonderful helicopter with this beautiful interior, now, you know, the process it has taken us to get to the point of actually having a usable product in the back of a helicopter has been, you know, 6 or 7 years long, and there's still parts of our interior that are not certified. The process of going through the regulatory certification process with Transport Canada is unbelievably laborious and expensive. You have to get everything pull tested and G tested to standards which are really quite ridiculous. I can't imagine it's any different in New Zealand because it seems to be fairly standardized around the world. And the number one thing I would try to impress upon you guys is please buy off-the-shelf products that someone else has already done the work on and make them fit in the interior that of the machine that you ultimately choose. That's a far more cost-effective use of your time than trying to do a customized, totally one-off or five-off interior, depending on how many machines you're going to put this in. It's been painful. We have a great machine, don't get me wrong. It's not like we don't like what we got in the end, but there are still major things, for instance, inability to carry isolates and other things related to the custom structure we have and other things that just have taken years and years and years of work and still aren't fully resolved yet because of the process of trying to get things certified. And it's ridiculously expensive to do that. And we're looking already potentially at new airframes, 5 to 7 years from now, again, because the EW, although it's a very nice machine, still can't land at many of the sites we'd like to land it at, still doesn't have the ice capabilities, even though we were told it was going to. And so we're looking at new airframes, down the road in probably a 5 to 10 year time frame. And when we do an interior in that, it's definitely, in my opinion, going to be off-the-shelf stuff that we put in it. It won't be anything customized on a new airframe if we go that route in the future.
Okay. We've got a few individual questions from the ergonomics team, Mike, so I'm going to hand the mic over to them.
Sure.
Hi, Mike. Cameron Rosie's my name. I'm one of the emergency specialists who doubles in the local ED and on the Rescue Helicopter Trust machine. Kind of back to what you were saying about fidelity in your mock-up testing. How important did you find that, getting the fidelity as good as you can? And I sort of suppose if you can contrast that with the fidelity that you'd use in a normal educational simulation, it sort of, from what I've been reading, it seems that people really, when we're talking about equipment testing, you want the best fidelity with respect to the equipment that you can. Did you spend a lot of time and effort on that?
We did. I mean, again, we had, we're very lucky at STARS. We've had some unbelievably talented people working with us over the years. And so we actually had a graduate student, a human interface design student that worked for us for, Keith Rock was his name, for probably, at least a decade. And Keith was really, really instrumental in designing a lot of our custom mounts and other things that we've made over the years. And the fidelity of the mock-ups that Keith would make were really impressive. I mean, right down to the very most intricate details of how latches worked, et cetera. And part of that was because he was making the real mounts anyway, and designing them and testing them at the same time. And so I do think that matters, and I think, getting back to what I was previously making comments about, I think, you should make the mock-up size of the airframes that you're going to be looking at as close to realistic as possible, including all the interior panels and things that we did that. We made all the interior panels out of various plastics and cardboard and other things, so they molded just in the exact right shape of the real aircraft, et cetera, and then put the real gear in there with as close to real mounts that you're going to buy as possible, because it really does make a difference to, we learned a lot about how our crew move around inside the aircraft. I mean, we have a huge helicopter now, the AW-139 is a beast, and there's tons of room in there, and so we needed to be able to move around and get access to all parts of the patient, which we can totally do now because our chairs move up and down, fore and aft, in the whole of the aircraft and actually swivel 360 degrees. So we can access virtually any part of the patient. And we wanted to be able to open cupboards and, change monitor settings and do CPR from virtually any position that we needed to. And the ability to touch things in the highest fidelity possible, you just learn things you're not otherwise going to figure out. And so the fidelity of the mock-up is very important, and the more talent you put towards that, that's money well spent for sure. Money is not well spent on trying to develop custom everything beyond that, if you understand what I'm saying, in terms of building your own mounts and building your own cupboards and building your own stretcher and all. Like, buy third-party stuff, put it in there, and then make it work through a good fidelity model. I don't know if I'm being clear or not, but that's the best advice I could give you.
That's a great answer, Mike. That answers my question really well. Thanks heaps.
G'day, Mike. Rob Gimmel here, one of the flight paramedics.
Yeah.
You've spoken very eloquently on the the pros and cons of a custom design versus a turnkey off the factory floor solution for you. How would you in the future procurement for your organization go about fitting your current cadre of medical equipment into a turnkey design? Or do you think for you guys it will be a process of having to rethink the medical equipment, how you carry it, to try and fit it into that, you know, that, you know, trying to fit a round peg into a square hole scenario?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the monitors you select, the you know, the patient sled or the cot that the patient stays on, all those things that you select, you really should be looking carefully at the two or three commercial options that are available on the market, and then looking to, you know, get those two or three options sent to you. They'll definitely do it. The manufacturers charge a lot of money for these things and have a vested interest in having marquee, you know, air transport organizations like yourself use their stuff. So they're quite happy to provide you, generally speaking, I would say, with the actual gear to test it out. And you know, I think you need to get that gear, two or three options for each thing that you're looking at, and put those mounts and those sleds in the mock-ups that you have, and get people to play around with them, then get consensus on what works best ergonomically within the confines of the two airframes you're looking at. And that's going to save you so much time and grief in the end, and cost in the end. And it's going to be perfect. You're never going to get everyone perfectly happy with whatever you choose, but you're looking for the best possible compromises with stuff that's trusted and true. And there's enough air organizations out there that you can rely on to give you their best sort of feedback for a variety of sleds and cots and mounts and other things that are available, that, you know, I think you can get your options narrowed down fairly quickly. I mean, if you contact Riga in Europe and, you know, and us and, you know, various other patients or programs like the Mayo and your, you know, compatriots in Australia, you can get things narrowed down, I think, pretty quickly to two or three choices for anything that you're looking at, and then get them, play with them, and see which ones you like.
That's excellent advice, Mike. One last question before we sign off here. Again, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to be a part of our podcast and a part of this program. The question is, what do you think the air ambulance of the future is going to look like?
I think it's going to look very close to what we're using now. I mean, I think any program, really, I mean, the patients aren't going to change other than getting fatter their BMI getting, you know, larger, to be politically correct, I suppose. So our structures are going to have to be a little wider, and our carrying capacity is going to have to be a little larger, or a lot larger, depending on your population, of course. With that aside, I really don't think it's going to look substantively different. I mean, I think about the way we did business I started 20 years ago versus now. It's really not that different. Our crew is better. There's no doubt about that, and their abilities are better. And we have a few things that we didn't have before, like blood and ultrasound on board. And so there's a few more, things that we do differently. But the overall interior to look at from the end of the patient isn't really going to change that much, because there's only so much you can put in a helicopter. These things are not going to get that much more lift capacity that we can fill them full of stuff. You're still, you know, busting the same air, physics and trying to lift things that really shouldn't be lifted. I just don't see it changing very much at all. The other thing I think we'll get is better communication and better ability to see what's going on in the air. We keep talking about, using things like FaceTime and video linkages so we can see what the crew is doing in real time, and, you know, either crew wearing sort of GoPro cameras or some other sort of Wi-Fi capable devices so we can be there virtually as physicians when we can't fly. I think that's where the money is and where the changes will happen and where we'll see some subtle differences. But overall, to look inside the doors of the helicopter, I don't think it's going to look much different than it did 20 years ago.
Awesome, Mike. Well, again, thank you very much for taking the time out of your day to speak with us. This has been very helpful. Just wondering, in the future, as we move through this process, it's going to be a couple of months we're going to contribute to this usability testing, if we can get in touch with you to pick your brain about things, obviously, as they crop up.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, myself, Greg Barton would be a huge resource for you. Well, Greg spent probably more time than anyone else in our organization, and is a very personable guy and a terrific paramedic, and loves his gadgets and great guy to talk to as well. And I'm sure Greg won't mind me throwing his name out there for you guys to talk to as well. So I'm happy to talk to you. Greg's happy to talk to you. We can put our engineering staff in touch with you as well. We're totally happy to help you folks in any way that we can, and vice versa. There's tons to be learned in both directions. Anytime you're looking at new aircraft, again, we may well be selecting new aircraft in not that long in the future. I don't think these AWs are going to last that long for us. So we may be looking to see what you learn through your process as well.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again, Mike, and have yourself a great day.
Nice talking to all you, gentlemen. Have a good day.
Take care.
Yeah, bye.
So on Mike's advice, we got in touch with Greg Barton, who was thankfully was more than willing to help out. And so the next conversation that you'll listen to is the interview with Greg. Greg, why don't you take a minute and introduce yourself to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, and then jump into talking about the usability testing.
Sure, sounds great. So my name is Greg Barton. I'm a flight paramedic with Stars Air Rescue. I also work casually as a ground paramedic. I've been a paramedic for 22 years and been flying with Stars for 14 years, and was involved in the design process of our AW139 cabin, and also the implementation lead for the AW139 to go into service in our Calgary base.
Excellent, excellent. So you've got a lot of experience then, obviously, in usability testing. Why don't you take us through the process that Stars went through sort of right from the beginning and try and highlight, you know, design principles, things that you learned from the experience, and things that you would sort of take away points and what you would change if you were going to do this whole thing again.
Absolutely. So back when we decided on the platform that we were going to go with, which was the 139, we started then determining what we needed through what we defined as a scope of work and a kind of a requirement in terms of what we wanted in the aircraft, both from an aviation perspective and an air medical perspective. We then looked around for vendors that were able to successfully, you know, guide us through the process, both of install and certification, which was kind of a new process for us, being that this hadn't been done before. So we ultimately landed on two vendors, one being HeliMods out of Australia and the other being Air Concepts International out of New Jersey, and the two worked in collaboration to come up with the ultimate design that we have in use today. So way back when, we went through a fairly extensive kind of a scope or a requirements document that was put together organizationally with input from all departments. And then we narrowed that down to something that was usable and going to be functional and economical as well, because that was kind of the overlying consideration, being that we're a charitable organization. So once we had that down to, you know, kind of the final document, then we proceeded forward with a PDR design process, so preliminary design requirements that were presented through to Air Concepts International and HeliMods. And we started basically with a blank canvas in the back of the 139 and started building it from the ground up. So we took our equipment to New Jersey, where the completion center was going to be, and met with both vendors and basically started putting forth designs in terms of how we wanted, you know, the equipment to be laid out in the aircraft, how it could be laid out in the aircraft, with, you know, aviation inputs, making sure that we were maintaining weight requirements so that it would be usable in the end, because there have been some other services that have come up with a product and realized after the fact, and then, you know, the aircraft manufacturer added on supplements after the fact that made it so heavy that you couldn't put in additional fuel, and it kind of minimized the usability from a mission profile perspective. So we went through the PDR process, which was quite elaborate, comprehensive. It was the first time I'd done anything like that, so it certainly was a learning process. And came to a design that we had agreed upon, put it back to, you know, the organization for our input, because obviously we want the end users, being the air medical crew and the aviators, as well as engineering teams, to be happy with the final product, because it was a custom build. And once we kind of got that finalized, we progressed through, did a midpoint review just to, you know, kind of finalize small details, and then moved into a CDR, or kind of a closed design review, where basically any modifications weren't going to be made beyond that point. So we were then going to proceed to the final install and ultimately acceptance of the aircraft.
Sorry to interrupt. How long did each of those initial, like those individual component processes take?
So, you know, when I look back in our documentation, we had plans, you know, for instance, for approximately a six-month process, I believe it was, for PDR. I'd have to confirm the exact timelines. And then obviously moving to CDR, which is approximately the same time frame, a little bit compressed. And then, you know, there was a roadmap that was laid out by the vendors in terms of how we were going to proceed to the final install, which looked great on paper when we first looked at it, and then realized as we were moving through the process, being that this was a custom install, we then had to get the regulatory bodies involved, being CASA out of Australia, and then ultimately Transport Canada. And there were some significant delays when we were waiting for Transport Canada final acceptance and sign-off. So like I mentioned, you know, we had our Vision Critical campaign to raise the money for the aircraft back in, it was 2001, and we just put the aircraft into service last year in Calgary.
Wow. So quite a lengthy process.
It was, you know, and there were a lot of lessons learned through that, and I think, you know, moving forward could certainly compress that, and you know, being that your team is engaged in this process now, certainly could offer some advice for you to assist in compressing that, and things that if we look back retrospectively, we may have done differently. So I'm happy to offer that.
That's exactly what we're looking for. We would love any advice to help make this an easy process.
Sure. So I jotted a couple notes down, and if I start getting off track for what you're interested in terms of input, please just stop me. But you had mentioned that you're looking at a more modular, kind of a clip-in interior. I think one of the big things looking back is looking at the suppliers and who has a pre-certified interior components that are already available. So you offload that responsibility from your organization, in addition to some significant costs, I'll add, onto the vendor to get those components, whether it be a floor, whether it be seating, whether it be, you know, mounts to mount your monitoring equipment, ventilator, et cetera, and basically let them present that back to you versus you being the primary source of, you know, input and taking on that responsibility of getting the certification done, because that is, it's a very complex and expensive and lengthy process. So that's kind of one of the biggest things, is just really offload that onto the vendor, you know, basically tell them when it's done, hand us the keys and we'll take that, and thank you very much. The other thing too is be mindful of moving forward having the entire interior certified as a whole, because we did do that with the 139, and I mean the end product's really great, but if you want to change any component of that down the road because you've decided, for instance, that, you know, your ventilator mount isn't where you want it, or you want to go to a different seat type, if it's certified as one entity, you can't change any of it. If it's certified with specific components, then you have the ability to change that as required. So I think looking back, that's another thing that we would have changed. And for us going forward, I mean, we're getting to the point where we're going to have to upgrade our BK-117s to a new platform. We're just going through this process right now. You know, that'll be passed on down through the line for the crew that's going to do the ultimate decision-making on our new platform. So that'd be another fairly significant component to keep in mind when you're moving forward with this. I guess the other thing being just having the the equation intimately involved in your decisions moving forward from a weight point of view. And we did that. But it's such a crucial component because, you know, as medical crew, we want everything, including the kitchen sink in the back. And, you know, it's great to add all of that, but there comes a point where, you know, we're not able to put on enough fuel to, you know, get out to where we need to and get back and still hold IFR alternates and whatnot. So I'm not sure how far out you're flying in New Zealand, but that's certainly a major consideration when you're deciding on the amount of equipment and just weight, you know, whether it be a composite floor or however the, you know, the floor pans out. Like, the floor is a fairly heavy component of the interior, so knowing how much that weighs and the different components weigh is fairly significant. Am I fairly on track?
Yeah, no, this is all excellent stuff. Just, can you highlight who was, like, what was the composition of your team from start to finish in terms of who had input at what stages?
Sure. So we had, from aviation, we had three kind of key members that were involved. We had two air medical crew members, and really the way I got involved, I mean, I had no specific training related to this other than my experience as an air medical crew member and just being an EMS from a practicality perspective. But we looked at kind of the 95 percentile and the 5 percentile in terms of air medical crew composition. So, you know, I'm 6'5", and then we took a nurse who was 5 foot nothing and basically started the process with that so that when we came up with the final product, usability for all in the back was going to kind of be met. So that's how I got involved in it. You know, it evolved from there. We also had engineering input, so, you know, from an access through service panels and whatnot, because that's obviously important as well. You know, it's nice to put in a Cadillac interior, but if the engineers or mechanics, I'm not sure how you refer to them, can't gain access to the components, or if the aircraft's going to be unserviceable for a significant amount of time while they're doing that, then it kind of negates the benefit of putting in that Cadillac interior. So they were involved to provide inputs. You know, we need to have a service panel access here so we don't have to take the entire wall out when we're doing this. We can just pop a service panel or, you know, how are we going to get access to the floor? And that's all, you know, you're kind of working fine ballet with the provider of the aircraft, in our case, Augusta Westland, and then the vendor doing the floor install, which was Helimods.
Gotcha. So it's a big, complex machine with a lot of moving parts by the sound of it that all have to sort of chime together to get it right.
Absolutely.
And at quite the cost. I'm just going to hand it off to any of the other guys here in our with us. Do you have any questions for Greg at all regarding the process they went through? Just one sec here. You're speaking to Rob, one of our intensive care paramedics.
How are you there, mate?
Sure. Good. How are you? I can hear you now.
Oh, good, good. Hey, just getting back to the scope, how important was it weight-wise in regards to your sorry, I've got microphones coming at me from all over the place here. Getting back to the original scope, how much importance did you and your team put on your existing mission profile back then versus what you guys felt could be or would be your potential future mission profile? Did you guys sort of, you know, dream of the future with the new aircraft?
We did, yeah. So absolutely, we dreamt big, you know, so we talked about everything from, you know, at the time we didn't have ultrasound or blood products or anything that's going to add significant weight, whether it be ECMO or whatever. And I mean, now we do currently carry portable ultrasound and blood products, but you know, we don't really have a mission profile where we are specifically that would warrant ECMO, but we did discuss that as an option. So I think, you know, thinking big, thinking outside the box of your standard equipment kit setup and looking to the future, absolutely, and we did do that. And I think that's important to do because, you know, as medicine progresses, as you know, so does equipment and the abilities for the pre-hospital providers you know, whether it be paramedics, nurses, or the physicians on board to provide care. And, you know, we're finding added benefit to that additional equipment we're able to carry, and we did factor that into the weight allowance.
Oh, that's good information. And yeah, getting back to sort of the kicking the tires phase, you know, you mentioned computer-aided design, and obviously there would have been lots of PowerPoint presentations flown around and glossy brochures that were viewed by everybody. But did you actually have any ability for the crews to be able to test different configurations and rear cabin designs in a tangible, let's sit in it and get a real feel for what it's going to be like to work clinically in this
environment? Absolutely. So we traveled. I went to Stansted in Switzerland to do a we went to the Aerolite factory when we were doing the initial vendor outreach and RFP, and looked at their kits. So at the time, Orange, I'm not sure if you're familiar with them, but it's the they're running the AW139s out of Ontario and Canada here. They had just gone through the mock-up phase, and you know, so we looked at that kit, and then we looked at the different components that they had. I went down to Bankstown just outside of Sydney and was on crew with the New South Wales team there, because they were using the HeliMods interior with an Aerolite floor in an AW139, so I got the opportunity to fly with them and see how things worked and, you know, sit down with the team and say, if you could make a wish list of things you'd like to add into this aircraft, what would you do? And we actually used a lot of those suggestions and put them in our aircraft.
Right,
trying to view and learn off
the mistakes and the positive outcomes from other operations was supremely important to your guys' project.
It's vital, you know. A lot of us are tactile learners, and I think to actually see something that's certified in an aircraft, whether it be at AMTC, the Air Medical Transport Conference, which runs throughout the U.S., or whether it be at AirMed, where they have different aircraft there, or it be the aviation expo that just occurred. I think it's valuable to actually take the time and you know, utilize some resources. I'm not sure if you're a charitable organization there. I'm assuming it sounds like you may be, or a component of it. You know, you have to be fiscally responsible with that. But I think in the end, when we're dealing with a multi-million-dollar aircraft and interior, it's a small expenditure to make sure that we're actually getting the right product.
Great. That's golden. Greg, thanks.
You bet.
So, Greg, again, we'd like to thank you for taking the time today to speak with us. This has all been excellent, and I think all of our crews will benefit from it significantly. I just was wondering if, you know, as this process is going to be rolling out over the next couple of months, if it's okay for us to get in touch with you again to pick your brain about certain things as issues arise and as we work through this.
Oh, it'd be my pleasure. Yeah, absolutely. You've got my email and my numbers as well. So please don't hesitate to contact me. I'd be happy to give you more info.
Perfect. Well, again, thank you very much from the Auckland Rescue Helicopter Trust. Have a good shift.
Thank you very much. Have a good evening.
Take care.
Okay, bye. Bye.
Our final guest is Dr. Sam Bendall from Sydney HIMSS. Most of you will know her and have worked with her. And Chris Duncan will take it away.
Do you want to start off, just for people that don't know you, by introducing yourself and then sort of talk us through the experience that you've had with Sydney in choosing new helicopters?
Sure. Okay. So my name is Dr. Sam Bendall. I'm an emergency physician and retrieval specialist at Sydney. I work for CareFlight and also for the Ambulance Service of New South Wales and the rescue helicopters. My job in CareFlight is primarily education. I have worked on the Hertz helicopter in Sydney, and I now work 2 to 3 days a fortnight on the ambulance rescue helicopter through CareFlight. It's a very complex operation in Sydney with multiple different types of aircraft, so this is a very interesting discussion for me. Do you have any specific questions you want to head up with, Andrew?
So I guess we're, as Chris has outlined, as you're aware, about to embark on some usability testing comparing rear cabin designs. We've taken sort of a New Zealand approach and went out and purchased ourselves some good 2x4 and plywood and have mocked up some rear cabins that we're going to spend the next 2 months doing simulation testing with our crews to try and identify which rear cabin design would be most beneficial given our mission profile. We would like to know sort of how Sydney would undertake such a process if they were going to purchase a new helicopter, or if you've been involved in this in the past, what process you went through and lessons learned from that process that we could sort of implement to try and avoid making mistakes that other organizations have made.
Sure. So this, it's actually a timely discussion to have because the new contract in Sydney has been awarded. So the processes behind the decisions were made last time that were made last time have been sort of thoroughly examined. So it's actually it's a good time to ask that question. So when the tender was up last time, what Keflight did was go over to other providers overseas, particularly places like Norway and Sweden and Germany and other places that fly similar kinds of missions with physicians on board, and had just have a look at their setups. And they were looking at particular aircraft, and so they were interested in the way that they set them up. So I think, you know, in accordance with a lot of usability testing is consult widely, I think it was one of our approaches. And it was really interesting to see the different setups and see how clever some people are with the small space available and what the different fit-out options were. In Sydney, it took a multidisciplinary team to fit out the current aircraft, and they went down to Adelaide and played with various permutations and combinations of the fit-out. But I think the key thing that they did well there was taking people from each discipline. So they took a crewy, they took a couple of paramedics, they took a couple of doctors, and the people who were going to have to use the aircraft in the end. So I think that was kind of the general approach. And now the new aircraft are being commissioned for 2017. So very smartly, the new provider is looking at the mistakes made. And I know we definitely have been some, and I'm happy to share those. And looking at how we can improve those. I mean, relatively minor tweaks in the scheme of things, but it was they have had a reasonable impact on our ability to use the aircraft to their fullest potential. So the little things like putting two handles on the door, because we've had difficulty closing the door in one of our type of aircraft, particularly in flight. So it's little things like that that will make actually a big difference to not only wear and tear in the aircraft, but also our ability to do our job easily.
So Sam, sort of from a nuts and bolts point of view, you said that you, once you'd consulted widely, you developed a multidisciplinary team to test out the platforms that you were going to use. Can you talk us through in a bit of detail about what that testing actually involved?
Yeah, so I'm talking here about, I'm sorry, I'm being very generalist, but I'm talking about two different organisations. So there was a tender process in 2006, and the tender was guided towards a couple of types of aircraft. And so our team went as a doctor, administrator, CEO team overseas to have a look around. The current providers have sent a multidisciplinary team, and they did not go into that overseas sort of have a look around, but they went down to Adelaide and basically took a crewy, I think they took two crewies, I know they took at least two paramedics and two doctors down there, and that was how they made the multidisciplinary team. In terms of the background of those people, I'm not sure, to be honest with you, whether they had any specific training in usability testing. I'm not aware of that. But I think the thought was, you know, a range of people who have been doing the job for a long time, and they did take a very experienced team down, who come from different organisations, so they could have different inputs. And I think that in itself worked well. Certainly one of the people who went down was aware of the... what had come out of the overseas experience and looking around at what we've got overseas. So there was some input from that point of view.
Cool. I'm getting questions waved at me by some of the boys here. I'll just put you over to Andrew to ask you a question. Here you go.
Right.
So obviously, without giving away what machines we're looking into purchasing, we were just wondering if you could comment on comparisons of rear loading versus side loading platforms and your experience with both.
Yeah, sure, no worries. So I've had quite a lot of experience in both now, both from similar aircraft to you guys and different ones as well. In my head, there's no question that loading sideways is easier. It's far easier, particularly if you have wide loading doors, to be able to control which orientation the patient goes in. So a lot of our patients now are transported, loaded east-west, but now transported north-south. But it also gives you the option to take two patients, and it's a lot less palaver than trying to do it in a rear loading aircraft. In terms of I think there's a couple of safety concerns with rear loading aircraft. The first being that obviously hot loading is just inherently dangerous because of the rotor being so close to actually where you're landing. And whilst we very, 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 very rarely hot load in either operation, in fact, bordering on never because of the safety concerns, if we did have to do that, obviously the safest place to approach an aircraft is 3 and 9 o'clock, sorry, and that's where you're loading your patient from, so your safety profile gets a bit better. For winching, it's much, much easier. It means you can actually use a reasonable size stretcher. And you can add other things, you know, like a tagline to make the whole operation safer. So it's much easier just coming straight in the door rather than having to come around the corner and then try and secure the stretcher, et cetera, et cetera. The other safety concern that I have is that sometimes you're sitting rear of them at your emergency exit. The rear opening doors are not emergency exits, as we all know, and sometimes, particularly as the doc, treating the patient, you're forced to sit further aft than your closest emergency exit, and sometimes there's something else in the way as well, which is not a great safety profile. And whilst we've tried to mitigate it in one of the organisations I work for, the practicalities of that are it just doesn't work. I can't reach the bridge and look after the patient if I'm located so far forward that I'm actually near my primary exit. So I think that's a big safety concern, whereas the east-west, so the side doors just takes care of all that because everybody's near their primary exit, and their secondary exit is also a pretty good good option as well. And for you guys flying over water, I think that's a huge safety concern and something that will be a big benefit for you guys.
That's great, Sam. I just want to talk a bit about sort of specifics about of it's Cameron Rosie here, in case you didn't recognise the voice. Just curious about the actual sort of how much input you guys had into the internal design process and whether it was driven by specific usability testing or whether it was just from viewing other operators. I mean, our plan is to build these mock-ups and run some simulation looking at specific tasks. Did you do any of that sort of process, or was it really mostly just based on what you'd seen at other operators?
This is a difficult question for me to answer without sounding political, so yep. I'll do my best. The short answer was that the aircraft came to the current aircraft configuration came to be through a tender process. So Tearflight was not successful in the tender, and we sent our teams overseas to go and have a look at that other people. I don't think we actually had a plywood mock-up of a helicopter, but which we used mainly for simulation prior, and we've done lots and lots of tweaks in our previous aircraft over time. I know that there wasn't a lot of simulation to come up with it when the team went down to Adelaide to come up with the current aircraft, because it was done, just the way it worked out, it was done relatively quickly. But I think their thoughts were, by sending a multidisciplinary team with lots of experience, then potentially they could get to where they needed to be a little bit quicker. However, there have been some, you know, and I'm happy to share these little bits. There have been some things that could have been done better, and everybody acknowledges these, and they'll be improved in the new aircraft. And these would have been picked up by usability testing. So, for example, the back seats, they are special drop-down seats, but there's no inertia wheel on the seatbelt. So once you're in the seatbelt, you cannot do anything in the aircraft. And so you know, just by workshopping little things like that, they would have realised that actually those seats are completely useless from a patient care and being able to do anything point of view. So I think there is a, I think in the next iteration there will be more usability testing before the final product comes to being, but also we will take the lessons learned from this this current contract and apply them. And certainly the senior people, particularly the base engineers and that sort of stuff, have already gone over to the new provider to start working on some of those things that are, that everybody has found out over the last 7 years that haven't worked particularly well. I hope that sort of answers your question.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful, Sam, and definitely supportive for us in trying to go forward and doing usability testing before we embark on the choice of helicopter. I'm just going to flip you over to Rob Gemmell, who's got a question for you.
Hey, Sam, how are you?
Hi, good. How are you going?
Good, good. The big question on everyone's lips, though, is when are you coming back to fly with us?
I'd love to come back to fly with you, Dad.
Anyway, with all your vast experience, particularly with these the rotation of your contracts in New South Wales, what do you think the air ambulance of the future is going to look like? You know, what do you foresee rescue helicopters and retrieval aircraft looking like in 10 years' time?
Oh, that's an awesome question. We were having this conversation in the aircraft the other night. So the aircraft of the future, we reckon, will be something like an Osprey that will be a hybrid fixed-wing and rotary wing aircraft. But they've got to stop crashing first. So, on a more serious note, I think that what we're learning over time is that you need to be specific about what you want your aircraft to do. And the thing I think we've learned in New South Wales that you can't be everything to everybody and still be light on weight and all that kind of stuff. So I think everybody's realised that if you want to have a multi-role aircraft, it has to be a big one. And big ones can still get into smaller places, but you need to have something with enough power to get you out of trouble. And something that can store both gear for secondary missions as well as primary missions on board and still conduct a winch mission and all that sort of stuff. And I think that's the reality of the job. We've tried here the last 7 years to have two types of aircraft, and the thought behind that was if one type of aircraft, there was a known problem with them, it wouldn't take the whole service out of action. That hasn't worked. Because it's necessitated, it's doubled the training load. There's been lots of different problems, and the thoughts were that we'd have one aircraft for short primary missions and one aircraft for long missions. But unfortunately, tasking doesn't work that way. You don't get a nice ordered tasking where one's going to be the urban mission, the other one's going to be the winch in the Blue Mountains. So they come in, unfortunately, and whoever's around has to go, which leaves the other aircraft. If that aircraft's not capable, then we're in trouble. So I think, to answer your question, the aircraft of the future will be a multi-role aircraft, lots of power, potentially a hybrid aircraft where you have got a fixed-wing capability with the rotary wing agility, and able to take at least two patients, I think, because I think if people get older and sicker, we're going to have to transport more and more people, and with the expense and the fuel costs going up, we're going to want to do it all at once rather than, and maybe even be able to take two crews. So I think that's probably where we're heading in time. And I think definitely having something with enough power that you can configure, you don't have to reconfigure every time for between primary and secondary missions, I think is a really key thing, because that will future-proof you somewhat.
That's awesome, Sam. We will let you go. Thank you very much for your time and letting us ask you a few questions. Just want to check whether it would be okay as we sort of go forward on this process of working out which helicopter we're going to go with in the future. Can we keep in touch with you for kind of tips and advice going forward?
Of course.
That'd be absolutely fantastic. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for your time today. And we will be in touch in the future.
Fabulous. It was great to talk to you guys. Take care. Good luck.
Cheers, Sam. Bye-bye.
See ya. Bye.